This week we will be studying 2 Kings 9:30 through 10:36, the end of that chapter. This passage has only three corresponding verses in 2 Chronicles, at chapter 22, verses 7 through 9. In this passage we will contemplate the remainder of Jehu's bloody reign over Israel, which we began studying last week. Jehu killed off the remainder of the house of Ahab, including Jezebel, and also killed many of Ahaziah's relatives, along with the worshippers of Baal. Certainly, Jehu did much killing. While some of this had been commanded by God, we also find evidence that Jehu went too far, and we have to question the ethics of his actions. He also had a reign that was less than totally faithful to God. Your passage for consideration is 2 Kings 9:30 through 10:36, and if you have not read it yet, I recommend that you pause and do so now. Previously in Kings and Chronicles, Ahab was Israel's most evil king. He and his wife Jezebel murdered the prophets and killed their neighbor Naboth to steal his vineyard. Elijah prophesied against them. Ahab died in battle. God told Elijah to anoint Jehu king so that he could kill Ahab's house. Ahab's son became king of Israel. His grandson, through his daughter, became king of Judah. The prophets anointed Jehu king of Israel, and he killed both kings. That leaves Judah with a power vacuum, which we will discuss next week, and this week Jehu will run through Israel on a massive purge, killing lots of people, fulfilling the prophecies, and finally bringing justice against the house of Ahab that Israel had awaited for decades. For more on all of that, you can go back and listen to the past 20 messages or so, covering 1 Kings 16 to today's passage, which is about 16 chapters. Of note, this period in Israel's history, during the time of the house of Ahab and the ministries of Elijah and Elisha, receives significantly more attention in the scriptures than most other kings after Solomon. So with that out of the way, let's get down to the killing. We've got four accounts of Jehu killing here, followed by a few brief notes about his reign. First, we have the death of Jezebel in chapter 9, verses 30 through 37, and then the killing of the sons of Ahab in chapter 10, verses 1 through 12, and then the killing of the relatives of Ahaziah in chapter 10, verses 13 through 17, and then the killing of Baal worshippers in chapter 10, verses 18 through 29, and finally the notes about his reign in chapter 10, verses 30 through 36. We start with the death of Jezebel. Jezebel was a very bad woman. Arguably, she was the cause behind all of these troubles. She was a Sidonian, not even a descendant of Israel, and it was her influence that had led her husband Ahab into Baal worship. See 1 Kings 16:32 for that. And she did many wicked things, including persecuting the prophets and ordering Elijah's death. See 1 Kings 18:13 and 1 Kings 19:2. It was she who arranged the murder of Naboth and the theft of his vineyard in 1 Kings 21:7 through 16. Once she had led her house into idolatry, a daughter of wicked Ahab married a son of Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, so that both kingdoms fell into corruption. Even after Jehu's revolution, that wicked daughter Athaliah would take over in Judah, where she would continue to have a bad influence. So this one bad marriage to an unbelieving woman led to heartache and suffering that spanned kingdoms and generations. I see a pertinent lesson here. Don't marry a bad woman. Don't let her take control of your family, and certainly don't let her rule your kingdom. But here Jezebel meets her end. When she heard Jehu was coming for her, she had an interesting response. She fixed her hair and put on her makeup. Painted her eyelids, to be a bit more literal. Painted eyelids are not viewed positively in Scripture. See, for example, Jeremiah 4:30 and Ezekiel 23:40, which associate painted eyelids with prostitution. I think also of 1 Timothy 2:9 through 10, which tells us that godly women are not adorned outwardly, but inwardly, with good works. The implication here, though, with Jezebel, is that she was intentionally dressing up like a whore, perhaps thinking she might woo Jehu with sexual wiles and thus rescue herself. Her words are more belligerent than that, though. She asked Jehu if he came in peace when he arrived, but also referenced Zimri, who murdered his master. You may not remember Zimri. He reigned for 1 week back in 1 Kings 16. We discussed him in our message, Chaos Reigns in Israel, back on May 5th of 2024. Zimri also had been a military commander who had killed his king, Elah, in a coup. That didn't go well for him, though. The people were not on his side. They crowned Omri king and killed Zimri. Omri had been Ahab's father, so this was recent history, familiar to everyone. The implication was that Jehu may have killed two kings, but that he would not have the popular support to overthrow her and seize power for long. Jehu dispelled that notion very quickly. He had merely to ask, "Who is on my side?" And several eunuchs, Jezebel's own attendants, in the room with her, volunteered. A quick note for anyone unfamiliar with the terminology, ancient kings had servants in their palaces, but they were concerned that those servants would lie with their wives and concubines, so they would remove their testicles to prevent them from doing so. These servants were called eunuchs. So the eunuchs were in Jezebel's room, but they were not on her side. A classic case of be careful whom you trust, I guess. Jehu had only to give the order, and the eunuchs grabbed Jezebel and threw her out of the tower window from which she leaned. She hit the ground with a great splatter of blood, and horses trampled her body. Jehu, in a show of unquestioned power, apparently rode right into town, literally over her dead body, leaving her there and sitting down to eat dinner. Once he had finished eating at her table, Jehu gave orders to have Jezebel's remains buried, but alas, no more than a few scraps of her remained, just hands, feet, and skull. Way back in 1 Kings 21:23, after the matter with Naboth's vineyard, Elijah had prophesied of her, from the New King James Version, quote, "The dogs shall eat Jezebel by the wall of Jezreel," though some manuscripts say Jezebel would be eaten on this plot of ground, rather than by the wall. Either way, apparently that's exactly what happened. Jehu was familiar with the prophecy and cited it. Evidently he knew a bit more of it than that had been recorded previously, and so he expounds that she was to have been devoured to such an extent that no one would be able to say, "Here she is." But as we know, the prophecy didn't end there. In 1 Kings 21, Elijah had prophesied the destruction of Ahab's entire house, like the houses of Jeroboam and Baasha. He said of Ahab's house, quote, "The dogs shall eat whoever belongs to Ahab and dies in the city, and the birds of the air shall eat whoever dies in the field." That is common biblical language, which is not necessarily to be taken absolutely literally, but which intends that the people described will die without dignity and not be given a proper burial. See, for example, the taunts of David and Goliath in 1 Samuel 17, 44-47. So up next, the slaughter of Ahab's house. Ahab had 70 sons, not uncommon, since as king he probably kept many wives and concubines. And so Jehu wrote to the leaders of the kingdom of Israel. He did not presume to be king over them without their consent, but rather told them that if they would continue with the house of Ahab, that they should appoint a new king from Ahab's sons and fight for their kingdom. No one was willing to defend the house of Ahab, and they were all much afraid of Jehu. So they capitulated and consented to Jehu's rule. Jehu wrote back telling them to prove themselves by eliminating his competition, bringing the heads of Ahab's sons to him at Jezreel. They had 24 hours to comply. And so they did that, killing the sons and sending their heads to Jehu, packed in baskets. Grisly work, I'm sure. The sort of thing that makes a man appreciate a peaceful transfer of power. I notice a trend here also. Jehu killed King Joram, but with all the other officials, he simply told their own servants to kill them, and they did it. This was a people who really didn't like their government. It takes a lot for bureaucrats to get to the frame of mind that scores of them are unflinchingly prepared to, at a moment's notice, kill the people who feed them. And Jehu wanted to make that very point. Ahab's house deserved what they were getting. God was on Jehu's side, and the people were as well. So to demonstrate this, Jehu piled up the heads of Ahab's sons and asked the people, "I killed my master, but who killed these?" This, I am sure, was an effective demonstration both of the guilt of Ahab's house and also of Jehu's uncontested power. Jehovah also was on Jehu's side, a point that Jehu made to the people with crystal clarity. He had done this in fulfillment of the prophecies of Elijah. And with that authority settled, he and his followers went on to slaughter Ahab's entire administration in Samaria, many of whom, I have little doubt, made protestations like, "I was just doing my job, just following orders, didn't know what the leadership was doing, couldn't have stopped them, etc., as it always is with bureaucrats who want to turn a blind eye and stay on the dole. It is my presumption that these men got what they deserved, but then it isn't all so simple. Certainly, the prophet who anointed Jehu gave him instructions by divine mandate to strike down all the males of the house of Ahab, but at some point he crossed the line into killing people he should not have killed. We know this because a couple of generations later we get a commentary on this purge by Jehu in the book of Hosea the prophet. He says in chapter 1, verses 4 and 5 from the New King James, "I will avenge the bloodshed of Jezreel on the house of Jehu and bring an end to the kingdom of the house of Israel. It shall come to pass in that day that I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel." So while Jehu was indeed doing God's work, at some point he was overzealous and took things too far. For that, the kingdom earned God's wrath. Exactly which killing went over the line is unclear, but Jehu had much killing yet to do. 2 Kings 10:12-14 certainly seems to cross the line to me. Jehu went on his way back toward Samaria, and on the way he met a traveling caravan of 42 men, among whom were King Ahaziah's brothers. King Ahaziah had been a grandson of Ahab by his mother Athaliah. However, his brothers were not necessarily so. They would have been sons of Jehoram, Ahaziah's father, but did not necessarily have the same mother. So whether or not these were technically of the house of Ahab is unclear, and that means they could have fallen outside the divine mandate to destroy Ahab's house. Regardless, Jehu had them captured and then killed shortly thereafter. That brings the kill count up to 115 people at a bare minimum, not including surely many nameless and faceless who have been unnumbered. And the killing continued. Still on the way to Israel's capital of Samaria, Jehu met his friend Jehonadab, son of Rechab. He is mentioned casually, as if we should know who he is, but this passage is the only one in Scripture to mention him. After ensuring that Jehonadab was supportive of the coup, he brought him up into the chariot and carried him to Samaria, where he put his zeal for Jehovah on display by killing all the rest of the house of Ahab. Now that, we know, was God's will, receiving the stamp of approval from our author as having fulfilled the prophecy of Elijah. And so, with the prophecy fulfilled, Jehu's killing spree ended. Except no, it didn't. Jehu didn't just want to wipe out the house of Ahab. He also wanted to kill all of the priests, prophets, and worshippers of Baal. Is this where Jehu crossed the line? It is maybe difficult to say. Surely this went beyond the prophecy, but it did not go beyond the law. The worship of false gods was clearly punishable by death under the law of Moses. See Deuteronomy 13:6-18. But then the way Jehu went about it was less than ideal. Jehu did not just punish people who worshipped false gods. He first encouraged people to worship false gods, entrapping them, and then engaged in an act of false worship alongside them, and only then, once he had led them deep into guilt, he killed. And he killed them without any trial or checks on his power. So he conceived of the sin, then performed it, then judged it, then executed the sentence. This is clearly not how a system of justice is supposed to run. It all went down like this. Jehu proclaimed a great sacrifice to Baal, which all of Baal's followers were ordered to attend. In fact, they were ordered to attend on pains of death. So if anyone had wanted to renounce Baal worship under the new administration, he had no opportunity to do so, and likely some who had not worshipped Baal prior to that point were drawn into doing so, seeing that Jehu was threatening to kill anyone who opposed him. The temple of Baal was positively packed. Jehu and Jehonadab did, to their credit, order a search of the crowd to ensure that there were no worshippers of Jehovah present, but the circumstances were still unseemly. And then, quote, he, end quote, offered a great sacrifice to Baal. That he, I think, is Jehu, though my current unjust imprisonment leaves me unable to check the language to be sure of that. So Jehu led the people in worship to Baal. Meanwhile, he had 80 men positioned outside, ready to kill everyone inside as soon as the sacrifice was over. And so they did. The whole matter was ethically questionable at best, but I'm sure it did wonders for cutting down on Baal worship. From there, Jehu and his followers destroyed and desecrated the Temple of Baal, using it as some sort of waste disposal, a dump or a latrine, depending on which translation you consult. They used it for that purpose until this day. That is, the time when the Book of Kings was written, some hundreds of years thereafter. Curiously, Jehu was then not wholly faithful to Jehovah. I would have expected that with all the deadly zeal like this, that he would have been faithful. Was Jehu's professed zeal really just a means of cementing his grip on power? Or did he lose popular support after so much killing and moderate his policies to appease the masses and keep his head? I suppose we'll never know his motivations. But he left the calf idols of Jeroboam standing, and in his governance he did not obey the laws of God. So Jehu has a mixed record. God was pleased with him for destroying the house of Ahab, but was also displeased with him for overkilling. And then Jehu was unfaithful. Had Jehu been faithful in all things, God may have blessed him with an everlasting dynasty like that of David. Had he been totally faithless, his dynasty may have been wiped out within a year or so of his son taking the throne. But Jehu was something in between, and so Jehovah told him, perhaps through a prophet like Elisha, that his dynasty would last for four more generations. We find the fulfillment of this prophecy in 2 Kings 15:12, when Jehu's great-great-grandson Zechariah suffered assassination at the hands of Shallum, who seized the throne. We note that David's dynasty in Judah remained unbroken, but within the century after the split between Israel and Judah, Jehu's would be the fifth dynasty of the northern kingdom of Israel. And of course, we should remember that to accomplish his coup, Jehu had left off defending Ramoth-Gilead, an eastern border town, from the Arameans. So while Jehu was butchering the entire government of Israel and many of its people, Hazael, king of Aram, took advantage of the chaos and conquered all of Israel's lands east of the Jordan. This also fulfilled Elijah's prophecy, and I suppose it was a cost which was unavoidable to purify the kingdom of Ahab's filth, but it was indeed a high cost. As for Jehu, he reigned 28 years. His works were recorded in the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel, and he died and was buried in the capital city of Samaria. His son Jehoahaz succeeded him as king. In application, I find a strange mixture in Jehu's reign. On the one hand, he was overzealous for God, but on the other, he was not zealous enough. He killed and killed and killed, but then somehow left the golden calves standing in Bethel and Dan. Perhaps the lesson we learn from Jehu then is something about moderation, finding a balance between going too far and not going far enough. The best advice I think I can give on that is to say that we should strive for faithfulness to the scriptures. Jehu had God's word, but in the written law and the orally fulfilled prophecy. He should have obeyed that without neglecting anything or adding anything, but he did neglect. He neglected to remove the golden calves, and he neglected to give a fair trial to the attendants of the temple of Baal. And he did add to God's word. God gave a command to kill the house of Ahab, but Jehu killed Ahaziah's brothers as well. And certainly Jehu should not have violated God's laws. He was commanded in the law of Moses to kill the prophets of Baal, but surely he was not intended to also invite people, even order people, into Baal's worship. Jehu was something like a bad archer. He was aiming at the right target, but instead of hitting it, he drifted off into extremes, often too far left or right of center, never perfectly on the bullseye. And I think that Jehu's lack of moderation was a symptom of power overly centralized. Through the course of the narrative, it appears that Jehu is accuser, judge, jury, and executioner. I see no evidence of any loyal dissenters giving him a contrary point of view that might have curbed his extremism. There were no processes in place to restrain his power. There were no checks, no balances. Seemingly it was just Jehu and a bunch of scared people carrying out all of his orders. We must recognize that none of us is perfect. We will all make mistakes. Unless there is someone to prod us, we will all at some point neglect our duties. And unless there is someone to restrain us, we will all go too far. This, for example, is why the scriptures tell us to have judges who conduct trials. This is why we have laws to ensure fair processes. This is why, in the Christian realm and in all of just societies, we favor democracy, juries, and checks on power. The Proverbs tell us at 15:22 that plans fail for lack of counsel, but with many advisors they succeed. Perhaps if Jehu had more people advising him and more restrictions in place, he would have made wiser decisions and been less extreme. We note among Jehu's failures his entrapment in the temple of Baal. Obviously, it is wrong to encourage people to do wrong and then punish them for that wrong. Unfortunately, we've seen modern law enforcement using this same bad tactic, whether it is by setting up fake terror plots or buying drugs to catch dealers. Entrapment is not moral, and perhaps more counsel and better checks on power could have kept Jehu from making that error. Perhaps Jehu also could have focused himself on what would have made for the most effective governance. Under his watch, Hazael, king of Aram, conquered all of the land east of the Jordan. That was something like half of Israel's territory. While they were doing that, Jehu was slaughtering his own people by the hundreds at least, and more likely into the thousands. As I have mentioned before, killing one's subjects, who might otherwise provide valuable goods and services, pay taxes, and fight the wars, is a bad course of action to be avoided as much as it is possible. Kill too many subjects, and you won't have a kingdom. But then, killing could not be avoided in Jehu's case. Israel had fallen deep into a self-destructive cycle of sin, which ultimately would have caused more harm than Jehu's purge. He had his orders. The house of Ahab had to be eliminated. Purifying the nation had to be done, but it came at a very high cost. Let us be wary not to fall into such sin that such a high cost should be necessary to cleanse us. And let us also not be overly critical of Jehu. He was a brave man who risked his life in obedience to God's command and who brought about a great work in eliminating the house of Ahab. He was not without his faults in doing so, but generally God was pleased with him and gifted him with a dynasty lasting to his great-great-grandson. And so we conclude our second and final week of study on the bloody reign of Jehu over Israel, as recorded in 2 Kings 9 and 10. Jehu's rise to power had been prophesied long beforehand by Elijah, who predicted that he would bring about the downfall of the house of Ahab. It was a long time coming, but eventually justice came. Jehu killed the kings of both Israel and Judah, as they were descendants of Ahab, along with many members of both royal families, including Jezebel, who was arguably the worst of them all, and then Jehu killed the worshippers of Baal. Somewhere along the way, Jehu crossed some lines into overkill, but he also failed to go far enough in eliminating idolatry. It appears that he would have benefited from a dose of humility, from some wise counsel, and from some checks and balances on his power. His purge of Israel came at a high cost, the loss of the Transjordan to Aram. Jehu was a mixed bag. He had his successes and his failures, but he was certainly consequential. Next week, we consider the consequences of Jehu's purge on Judah, where in the vacuum created by the death of the king, Athaliah rose to power. For those of you who are listening to this message away from your computer and are looking for more like it, you can find us at eastjordan.church.